way, Nancy thought, keeping her eyes wide. When you look away, that's when he teleports behind you and kills you. Daddy sure played the games enough. Nancy kept silent, staring at the monster, her eyes growing increasingly painful until the pain finally forced her to screw her eyes shut.
Oh no, he'll get me.
Nancy dodged the inevitable backswipe by rolling across the floor, then looking behind herself.
Nothing there.
She glanced back at the chair and was flummoxed when she spotted Slenderman still sitting where he'd been. He cocked his head. Nancy cocked her head.
Child?
Now that she got a better look, it was just a Keegan. A Keegan in a suit. Weird.
I want to go home,
Nancy said, standing with her hands clenched into fists.
Sadly, I lack the power to grant that request. I can't bring your mother and father back to life, just as I can't unstitch your world.
That's not...
Nancy's throat choked up at the mention of her mommy and daddy.
Oh? You feel like a small library in an abandoned section of a shopping mall qualifies as a home? I imagine the pain of hunger in your stomach is nostalgic for you, too.
Stop it,
Nancy said. He was being mean with his words, without Nancy knowing exactly how he was doing it. He wasn't calling her names or sticking out his tongue, but all she knew was he was making her feel really bad. The Keegan's expression softened.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend. I simply wanted to illuminate the truth.
What truth?
You don't have a home like me, the Keegan said, his eyes looking almost sad.
Do too,
Nancy said.
I've got Colt and Damien and Bess and...
Those are just strangers you've been clinging to, hoping for scraps. They aren't family. What have they done to help you? No, much more importantly, what have you done to help them?
I...
Nancy twiddled her fingers as a wave of guilt crashed over her. She got yelled at when she made the sign out front. She got yelled at when she tried to make book soup, when she peed the bed, when she ate the last of the candy.
Face it, you don't have a home.
I guess not,
Nancy admitted.
That's not all bad, though. There's one good thing about not having a home.
Doesn't seem like it,
Nancy said, tears welling in her eyes.
The silver lining here is that not having a home gives you a chance to make your own.
What?
Nancy frowned.
What do you think your mummy and daddy did? They made their own home, with you included. You can make a home too. It just takes time.
Do I have to be a mommy?
Nancy asked, screwing up her lips. Mommy and Daddy did some weird, loud stuff when they thought she was asleep.
No, no,
the Keegan laughed, waving a bony hand.
That's a different matter altogether.
Phew.
You can make a home where you and all your friends can live forever. All you need is the time to do it.
How?
Nancy asked, walking around the edge of the couch and sitting back down.
With a lifetime of effort,
the Keegan said, reclining in his seat.
A lifetime?
Nancy whimpered.
Youth is the gift of life breathed into us by Mother Vreshna. This vital energy fades over time, which is what leads to aging, and eventually, the death of all things. But what if I told you there was a way to beat aging, a way to live forever gaining the strength and time you need to build a home for you and your friends. And you'd never have to see them unhappy ever again.
Nuh-uh. Daddy says aging is when damaged DNA gets copied when cells split. Eventually they forget how to fix themselves. He said scientists are about to figure out how to stop aging by fixing DNA with CRISPR, but they're never going to make it public because rich people don't want to share.
Linus's jaw hung open for a second. It closed. It opened.
Ahem. The Keegan coughed into his fist. Humans certainly have active imaginations.
Nuh-uh. It's the truth. Daddy's never wrong.
Except the time he got himself killed, I assume.
Nancy's face crumpled, her eyes burning with pain, loneliness, and shame. She gripped a pillow off the couch and started sobbing straight into the soft velvet, heedless of the salty tears and snot working their way into the expensive fabric.
That's not a... Never mind. Go nuts.
About 10 minutes later, she had post-meltdown clarity and a case of hiccups. Nancy was ready to talk again.
Anyway, the people of Pharos have found a way to eliminate aging entirely. And I'm going to help you do it for yourself.
Why?
I lost my home, too, Lenos said, tapping his chest. I want to give you the time you'll need to make your own.
You're mean.
I'm practical. I'm too old to do it now, but you...
He gestured to Nancy.
You're young enough to make it past the Ossut bottleneck.
The what?
The Ossut bottleneck. It was named after the scholar Ossut, who discovered that the anti-aging properties of the body attribute can be used to provide true immortality at high enough potency, and that the required amount is quadratically higher depending on the creature's current biological age. In essence, at the age where a normal young man could hope to defeat monsters and gain levels, it is already too late. The amount of levels he needs would take longer to acquire than the aging they would prevent. Sure, he could live hundreds of years, but it would be almost impossible to achieve true immortality just playing catch-up with his own aging.
Lenos spread his hands.
The Ossut bottleneck.
I don't get it,
Nancy said, shaking her head.
That's all right. All you need to know is that it'll give you the time and strength you need to make a home that no one can take away from you. If you let me help you.
I can invite all my friends over to my home?
Of course, Lenos said.
Nancy peered at him, her mind dancing with the possibility of lazy days spent reading books while hanging off the edge of furniture, chasing each other around a big house, eating together.
What do I need to do?
Jebediah Trapper.
Okay. Jeb breathed quietly, slipping the ring farther up the handle of the hook until he could keep it in place with his right hand. With his left, he gently placed the very tip of his middle finger against the hook and began feeling around. He used the flat side of the hook to feel for the stitches. From feeling around with his fingertips earlier, he was fairly sure it wasn't a zipper or legs sunk into a scalp, but stitches securing some wriggling thing to his skull. There's one, Jeb thought, feeling it out using the hook as a medium. He guided the edge to the stitch, took a deep breath, and began gingerly sawing at the material. He kept perfectly still, expanding all his senses outward as he tried to keep track of every tiny sensation. Damage to the brain won't register as pain. It'll register as dizziness or a funny taste, maybe even a sudden change in mood. Jeb thought, his heart thudding out a heavy beat as he sawed. Pop. There was a sudden
loosening as the hook sawed through the stitch, a relaxing that rippled through his consciousness and his mist core. Instantly, the sensation faded before he could even put a name to what was different.
The fuck was that?
Jeb thought, blinking. He paused a moment to take stock of his mental faculties.
I don't feel like I have brain damage, but then again, who does? No time like the present.
Whatever it was existed in another dimension and was not naturally occurring. Jeb was determined to remove it and anything else that had been soldered into him without his knowledge or consent.
There's always the chance it'll turn me into a drooling vegetable or have me bleeding out on a plane of existence I can't even interact with.
Worth it. The ew factor was just too high, having something alive strapped to him, possibly influencing his decisions on a level he couldn't even understand. Nobody wanted to be a cordyceps zombie. After he tested his smell, taste, balance, and ability to count backwards from 10, Jeb resumed the work. Pop. Another stitch came loose, accompanied by a quickly fading sensation of loosening. Pop. 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 The stitches began to move back and forth, making it difficult to work. Frowning, Jeb took the hook away and slipped the ring onto his finger, feeling around the area. The long lump was thrashing back and forth, struggling against the loosening stitches. All right, Jeb thought, slipping the ring back onto the hook. It rattled all the way down to the handle.
Rattled?
Jeb peered closer at the steel hook and noticed its surface was pitted and worn. It wasn't rusted out, but seemed as though it had been eaten away by acid, with tiny pinhole-sized pits in the surface.
Worry about it later.
Jeb needed to strike while the iron was hot with the lump. He found his spot again, working from the other side, pushing the worm-like thing down with the handle while he sawed away at the stitches. Pop. Pop. Pop, 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 pop.
Here it comes,
Jeb thought, barely keeping his presence of mind through the series of ripples traveling through his being. The last stitches were coming undone on their own, and the creature, whatever it was, would soon be free to get the hell off of him.
But we're not going to let this go that easily.
Pinning the creature down as best he could with the handle while making sure the rest of the stitches really were gone, Jeb flipped the hook around, sliding the blunt side around the worm-like creature's midsection. He released the ring with his right hand, letting it slide down the handle until it was bumping up against the invisible thing he trapped against the side of his head. Jeb grabbed the ring with his left hand and began drawing the creature through the ring hole with his right. The hook and ring combo began to buck in his hands, shaking violently as some implacable force resisted the transition. Jeb pulled the whole thing away from his head, the creature effectively trapped between the ring and the hook. He leaned forward, holding the two close to his chest and putting leverage to work, straining with a level of effort reserved for the most stubborn of pickle jars. The invisible thing continued to thrash, jerking his hands from side to side, seemingly with the weight of a full-grown man thrown into it. Jeb was concerned about the damage the thing might be doing to his fifth-dimensional body that he couldn't even perceive. Still, he wanted to see the damn thing with his own eyes, and so he continued to pull, struggling to tug the worm through the ring. Despite putting all his leverage and strength into it, the creature refused to cross dimensions.
Go figure, Jeb thought, scowling.
He only had one thing left to try at this point. Jeb took a deep breath and funneled out the thickest strand of mist he could possibly manage, sending it through the ring and seizing everything on the other side and yanking it back through. Well, he tried. As soon as the mist made contact with the center of the ring, a flash of light stabbed into Jeb's retinas, along with a bloom of heat that singed the tips of his fingers that were fixed around the edge of the appraiser.
Duh!
Jeb dropped the burning hot ring to the floor, rubbing his eyes with his seared left hand.
Damn it!
Jeb muttered, blinking the tears out of his eyes.
At least I got rid of the thing.
Jeb?
Smartass called his attention, and Jeb glanced at her dim shape. She pointed toward the metal tool in his hand. Jeb glanced down, trying to see through the afterimage dimming his vision. It actually looked like there was something wrapped around the hook.
crap!
Jeb tried to drop the stick, but the snake-like creature recovered first, flashing up the metal rod and onto his forearm. Out of the undamaged periphery of his vision, he could make out green scales and a strange, jawless mouth. The creature reared back, revealing fangs, and Jeb felt a sting on the flesh of his forearm. In panic mode, Jeb tore the creature off and threw it across the room. It hit the back wall and wriggled under his desk.
Master Kanoth, I don't feel so good.
Jeb heard himself mutter as he stumbled backwards, his shoulders ramming up against the unpainted wall.
Jeb, are you okay?
Smartass asked, fluttering up into his face. Jeb couldn't manage to find the ability to answer Smartass. He knew he probably could, but there was a strand of thought in his head that didn't want to do that, and it stood between him and the fairy. There was no strand of thought preventing him from watching the desk, though. He needed to be ready in case the creature came crawling out.
Gotta be ready. Why is the room sliding sideways?
Oh, right. It's bedtime in the academy. Mavar closed his eyes, relaxing into the itchy woolen beds of the academy. Apprentice wizards were denied all but the most basic comforts. To better enhance their studies, they said. Mavar thought it was because they were cheap. Mavar's fingers scrunched the silk covers. Wait, silk? The tiny inconsistency allowed something older and darker to peel away the facade of Mavar, reeling in the darkness.
Nope, nope, nope.
Jeb thought, sitting back up with everything he had, organizing and fortifying his thoughts and identity, shoring them up against the strange thoughts and sensations. Jeb tugged all his thoughts and feelings, all his memory, close to the gaping wound in his mind, choosing his PTSD as the battlefield, so he would feel the strange thoughts approaching a mile away. As painful as it was one of the cores of his identity and wouldn't go away from a little Mavar juice. He ran his thumb over the scar on his palm, focusing his thoughts on the spike.
Am I dying right now? My chest feels heavy. I promised him. Did Tyler take my place? Do I deserve to die instead?
Chuckling, Jeb dragged his mind into the dark well of PTSD. He'd been here before, after all, but young Mavar had no tolerance for that sort of bullshit, and the invisible strands of the young man's thoughts were viciously torn apart by the burgeoning weight of Jeb's damage. Just one problem. Tyler was standing outside the door. Jeb's eyes ached from the strain as he watched the ghost of his past rush to his side, struggling to pull the beam out of Jeb's chest.
Jeb! Hold on, man. I'll get you out of there. Am I gonna die?
Jeb heard himself whisper. He couldn't move air through his lungs, only the blood-soaked oxygen already in his throat.
You're not gonna die, I promise!
Tyler said, grabbing his hand. The blood from the cut on Tyler's hand mixed with Jeb's.
I'm gonna get you out of here!
Jeb was jettisoned out of his own body as a ball of burning golden fire. The seam below him was frozen in place. Two men, one on his deathbed, the other clutching his hand. A scene that had played out time and time again in Jeb's mind, always with the wrong actors.
Tyler is the one who died. Not me. Why do I dream about myself being the one dying so often?
The scraps of Jeb's consciousness wandered. There was a strange web between the two frozen men, a gossamer promise made of glowing, immaterial woven gold. Something in Jeb's core told him that it really was Tyler's promise.
Or perhaps powered by it?
The scene began to play in reverse, and Jeb watched in fascination from his strange, omniscient viewpoint as the world rewound like an old VHS tape, the gossamer thread traveling with the two actors. It rewound, showing the two of them prepare for bed, getting all their gear squared away in the nitpicky way their drill sergeant had, well, drilled into them. It rewound further, showing the 2 hours of R&R before bed where they had been drinking and playing Mortal Kombat. Like a living thing, the gossamer gold seemed to sense an opportunity, jumping into Jeb's body with a soft flash of light. The scene resumed in regular time, and Jeb watched himself get beat by Tyler repeatedly, a gold flash in his eyes appearing every now and then just before a critical error. Of course, every game in the army is also a drinking game, and Jeb was forced to imbibe an inordinate amount of beer, sending him into a spiral of defeat. The exact same scene replayed itself as they stowed their gear, got ready for bed, lay down. But this time, Jeb was the one who got up in the middle of the night and went to take a piss, not Tyler. What the hell am I looking at? Jeb thought, reaching for the scar in his palm.
The power of a promise. Do not make them lightly, Sion.
Unfortunately, as a ball of bright orange light, he didn't exactly have a palm to check his scar, sending a wave of dread through his ball.
Am I dead? Did I finally manage to kill myself and this is what I wanted to happen? Or is it just omniscience in death that allows me to see all the ways things could have been?
Jeb glanced up and spotted wood above him, the cracks in the ceiling slowly growing. Any second, they would send beams crashing down into his chest. He needed to get out.
Right now. But I don't have a body. How the fuck am I supposed to get out of here?
The beam fell through the ceiling and slammed into his chest, which he now had. Tyler was standing outside the room.
No, fuck this. This already happened. I'm alive.
Jeb shouted, his body fueled by pissed-off outrage, beating back the fear for a couple seconds. Long enough to hear what Tyler was really saying.
Jeb! Jeb, wake up!
Wake up? I can't open my eyes. My eyes are already open. I'm not dreaming. I can't be dreaming. My eyes are already open. This is real. This is not real. Can't be real.
Jeb looked up at Tyler. Really looked. Tyler had white hair and crow's feet around his eyes. Tyler wasn't Tyler at all. It was Mr. Everett shaking the shit out of him. Jeb's throat was hoarse, probably from screaming.
Anybody see the thing that bit me?
Jeb whispered, his voice not quite working as he tried to sit up.
Huh?
Mr. Everett asked, frowning. Something bit you?
Under the cabinet,
Jeb whispered, pointing, his limbs weak from adrenaline backlash. Cautiously, Mr. Everett knelt down and peered under the desk, scanning back and forth. A moment later, the old man grunted, leaning down further and reaching under the cabinet.
Is this dude crazy?
Jeb thought. The thing, obviously, had sent Jeb on a hell of a trip and nearly killed him.
Nothing under here but this,
the teacher said, pulling out a book.
Looks like an unused diary or something,
Everett muttered, flipping through the pages.
Doesn't have anything written on it.
He tossed the book onto the bed.
I'll check under the bed, Everett said.
Never mind,
Jeb said, finding his voice as he stared at the book. Its cover was made of green, scaly skin, with two long fangs bracing either side of the binding and rib-like bumps on the sides.
I had a flashback.
You sure?
Everett asked, raising a brow.
No trouble at all.
I'm sure. I get flashbacks every now and then. I'll live.
Jeb shrugged.
But if you want to check under my bed for spooks, more power to you.
The teacher chuckled and checked under Jeb's bed and nightstand, declared the room clean, and bid Jeb a good night. Jeb picked up the book. Principles of Mist Sensors and Behavior Programming 101. Jeb cracked the book open, studying the first page.
Can you read this part too?
Jeb asked, pointing to the signature at the bottom.
What part?
Smartass asked, frowning as she studied the paper. This book is owned by Mavar Salas. If found, please return to room 113 of the Mesticos Mist Academy.
Huh. That's odd. I wonder.
Jeb took the appraiser and blew a cloud of smoke, stepping into its effect.
Jebediah Trapper. Mystic Trapsmith, level 39. Accolades. Cruster's Brawn, Siren's Cunning, Rub-Rub-Rubu's Mysteries, Gresh's Subtlety, Innovator, Lagross's Power. Body, 21. 9. Mist, 71. 16+3. Nerve, 26. 10. Abilities. Fatal exception. Ability missing or corrupted. Awaiting resolution by administrator. Accolade pending. Lagros's power suspended due to multiple instances. Awaiting resolution. Attention! This user has been flagged for exclusion from the system by executive order.
Jeb raised a brow, thumbing his chin. He glanced between the book on the bed and the missing ability. Mystic Trigger. Principles of Mist Sensors and Behavior Programming 101. So I had information and experience stitched into my head? Jeb thought. The information was the book. The experience was the memories of the Mavar kid. Why am I the only one who can read it? Why was it a snake thing? Why should I care?
Jeb picked up the book, sat down on the bed, and started reading.
Chapter 15. Knock Knock.
Boss!
No. Jeb grunted, peeling his eyes open to stare at the ceiling. Principles of Mist Sensors and Behavior Programming 101 lay open on his chest where he'd simply dozed off somewhere halfway through the night.
There's some kid at the door, Mr. Everett said, jutting his head through Jeb's door. You want to check it out?
I thought I locked that thing, Jeb muttered, eyeing the door.
Given your mental state, we thought it would be best if you didn't have a locking door, so Pedro swapped it out while you slept.
Mr. Everett gave him a big grin.
Anyway, everyone else is busy, so hop to it, boss.
The teacher ducked back out of his room and clumped through the hall, his footsteps swallowed by the sound of carpentry in progress. Jeb got a waft of wood scent from the doorway.
When did I lose control here?
Jeb muttered, sitting up and putting on his pants, shirt, and leg.
He's just trying to make you feel needed,
Mrs. Everett said, barging in the door. Jeb yelped and covered himself, glaring at the matronly old lady, setting the platter down on his desk.
That's how my Harv shows he cares, she said. Hands up.
What?
Without warning, the old lady brusquely yanked the shirt over his head and then bent down to grab his pants.
Whoa there, that's far enough,
he said, grabbing his waistband.
Please,
she said, rolling her eyes before yanking his pants and underwear off.
You've got nothing I haven't seen 1,000 times.
Jeb probably could have stopped her, but that would involve getting into a wrestling match with an old lady, and that wasn't really high on his bucket list, so he let her get away with it.
What's your waist and leg size?
She asked, folding the clothes over her shoulder.
36, 34,
Jeb said, frowning. She opened the door, revealing a cart full of clothes and food, along with a basket full of dirty clothes where she dropped Jeb's old pair. She went through the tags for a moment before finding what she was looking for.
Here.
She tugged out a pair of jeans and tossed it at him, along with a new pair of underwear and a shirt. That done, she put her hands on the cart and moved to the next room.
Looking good, boss,
one of the janitors said from where he was fixing the second-story railing, giving Jeb's a thumbs up. Jeb slammed the door shut with telekinesis. You get about the same level of privacy in the army, so it was nothing Jeb wasn't used to, but still, the casual disregard for their owner's comfort stung a little. Jeb glanced at the steaming beef soup on the desk with a BLT beside it, then at the non-greasy pair of underwear in his hands.
On the other hand, forgiveness is divine, Jeb thought, grabbing the soup and wolfing it down before jumping into his new clothes.
He still had to go answer the door. A flat 60 seconds later, Jeb yanked the front door open, revealing Rufio, looking pissed and impatient as hell.
What's up?
Jeb asked, taking a bite of his BLT in front of the starving kid. This wasn't entirely to torment the teen for being a teen. It was also to signal that there was food on Jeb's side of the fence. That probably wasn't lost on the boy, as his eyes tracked the sandwich like it had begun to sing and dance.
You said something about catching the guy who took Nancy. I'm here to talk.
Excellent. Let's sit at the bar in the kitchen. Mrs. Everett can fix you up something.
No.
Rufio scowled at him, tearing his eyes away from the sandwich.
No.
We're not talking until you show me every room in this place.
Jeb pursed his lips.
Sure, kid. Knock yourself out.
He opened the door the rest of the way and stood aside. I'm going to stay at the bottom of the stairs until you finish looking up there, Jeb said. Holler when you're done. Jeb had no interest in following the kid around as he made extra double sure Nancy wasn't being kept here. Why would I be keeping Nancy here if I'd already given him the address? Jeb thought, resting his chin on his palm. The boy was suspicious and untrusting, which was good, but he was plainly a teen of limited experience. This'll probably take a while. I'm curious as to what Eddie has gotten done. Jeb hauled off and went around to the back of the mansion into the storm cellar, where Eddie was working on Buddy. Buddy was a bomb-defusing robot with decent armor and resistance to getting blowed up. Eddie was currently attaching the fireball wand to the front of the robot's controllable arm. He created a machine that twisted the rangefinder on the wand back and forth with the speed and precision only a robot was capable of. It was connected to a firing mechanism that threaded back under the robot's armor, along with a set of shiny motors Jeb hadn't seen before. "How's it going?" Jeb asked.
"Well, I replaced the entire battery power system with a pair of two-stroke motors. Two-stroke motors aren't the most efficient, but fuel isn't a problem, and with them offset like this, we should get a full power stroke with minimal vibration. The gas tank is fed by a lens I carved off the big one according to your light ray theory,"
he said, pointing to what looked like a gasket attached to the top of the small fuel tank.
"So I had an issue with throttling the gas output, but I managed to figure out what functioned as a resistor in the mist regulators you gave me."
He pointed to a little chunky piece of steel and pried it open to show the regulator encased in soft foam.
"Since you claim mist from an engine acts as sort of radiation, the first thing I thought of was a way to increase the resistance to decrease the regulator's release speed. So I busted the regulator open and checked the walls. And sure enough, the business end had what looked like a piece of glass electroplated with gold. The walls and receiving end are coated with a material I don't recognize, but they aren't immediately important. I would guess they're some kind of one-way transmissible material."
"So it's like a laser, with a one-way mirror on one side and a slightly less powerful mirror on the other," Jeb said.
"Eh, I'm more like a leaky fuel tank. My theory is that when the pressure in here reaches a high level, the mist actually reverts back to a gaseous state until the pressure forces it out the gold side as light again. Once that happens, the floodgates are open, and it drains out until it's empty again, but never faster than the gold resistor here will allow. So I took a few pieces of glass and electroplated them with varying concentrations of dissolved gold, and just recently got a regulator plate that limits the gas output enough that the machine doesn't leak fuel everywhere and catch fire. There's a fuel sensor and a manual disconnect, so the robot can remove the mist power from the fuel supply if it ever gets over full, too. I don't have the same weight restrictions I would if this were a drone, so I was able to put a honkin' DC engine in there, which gave me enough power to overclock the motors in his joints and give Buddy some sick moves."
And he pulled up the robot's control pad and pressed a few buttons. The motor turned over and caught, filling the room with a loud rumble. Eddie put his hand on the chassis of the robot.
"Feel that!"
Jeb followed suit, and remarkably, the robot barely trembled despite twin motors blasting away inside it.
"Now, a normal bomb disposal robot is pretty much just a fancy RC. I had to add some think meats to it, which took up space and caused some heating concerns, but I think I did a pretty good job, all things considered."
He pushed another button, and Buddy's arm with the fireball wand whipped up and aimed at Eddie, the rangefinder zooming down to the 20-foot minimum in a fraction of a second. Click, click, click. The robot dry-fired the wand 3 times at Eddie's heart before moving on. The arm spun to aim at Jeb's center mass a split second later, sending a wave of ice down Jeb's spine. Click, click, click. Did Eddie just almost blow us up? Eddie entered another command, and the mechanical arm relaxed back to its resting posture, tucked in tight against the armor.
"Remote control is a little too slow. I'll program this a bit further with some strong friendly fire protocols, but it should help rapid response times if it locks onto its targets by itself, at least."
Jeb glanced at the old man's damp clothes, shock of wispy hair, and the huge dark circles under his manic eyes. "Good job. Remember when I bought you today?"
"Yeah, what of it?"
"That was 2 days ago. Get some sleep. I can't afford to have you slip up making something that dangerous. You could have just blown up the entire house.
But I'm almost done, Eddie whined. I lose track of what I was doing.
Your owner demands it, Jeb said, grabbing him by the shoulder.
You're just as bad as the dean,
Eddie sulked as Jeb shoved him out of the basement. The old man literally hissed as the light of morning struck his eyes, shielding his face from the wrath of the sun.
He went out here to check on Eddie.
Mrs. Lang's voice came around the corner as Jeb shoved the thin old man in question towards the front of the mansion. Here, Jeb said, pushing the roboticist forward when Mrs. Lang appeared around the corner of the building. Make sure he gets 8 hours of sleep, at least. And don't allow him to put a cot in his workstation either.
Sure, boss,
Mrs. Lang said with a smile, her hand digging into Eddie's shoulder. A moment later, she was steering the scientist away, leaving Jeb with Rufio. Find anything suspicious?
I found a stack of nudie magazines, but they featured Keegan, so I assumed they belonged to the previous owner.
Seriously?
Hell no, old man. Where did you come from?
You're not going to be satisfied until you check everything, are you? In response, Rufio crossed his arms and scowled. He had a bit of mayo on the corner of his mouth. Mrs. Everett must have fed him already. Excellent. All right, right this way, Jeb said, guiding him to the storm shelter, where the teen spent the next 15 minutes alternating between geeking out over magic robots and looking for trapped doors to hide children in. All right, that's enough, Jeb interrupted when he saw Rufio checking the same corner the umpteenth time in a row. It's not me, and if you keep this up much longer, I'm just going to find someone else to help me. Now, can we talk about how this plan is going to work, or do you want to leave? Rufio took a deep breath and shook his head.
No, man. I can't just trust some rando who shows up wanting to house kids out of the goodness of his heart. I'll take a pass.
The kid turned towards the door. More of your friends will die, Jeb said.
It's my problem, not yours,
Rufio replied, glancing over his shoulder as he mounted the first step. Smartass, Jeb muttered, poking his collar. Back me up here.
What?
Smartass grumbled, emerging from the shade of his collar. The fairy had a tendency to sleep in if there was nothing going on.
Ooh, a child!
Smartass cried, her wings kicking into high gear and buzzing all the way over to the stunned Rufio, who watched her with wide eyes.
A bit past its prime impact-wise, but still technically a child,
Smartass said, tugging at the boy's earlobe, then dodging a swat.
Tell me, child, do you want to make a deal? Save your friends, perhaps? How about a decade of indentured servitude? That's a small price to pay for their lives, don't you think? If that's too immediate, we can always settle for your firstborn. It's a classic.
What the hell is that? Rufio demanded, pointing at the fairy whirling around him. Smartass, calm down. I'm not going to let you make a deal with him. Smartass led it back to Jeb's offered palm, grumbling all the while. This is a fairy, Jeb said, holding out the reclining smartass for Rufio to see her holding still. They have a very difficult time telling lies. Drawn back from the steps by the sheer strangeness, Rufio approached the fairy and poked her cheek. Irritated, the little creature slapped his hand away.
Hands off! Fairies are real?
They are, and this particular one is working for me.
Technically, Smartass said. Although I think it should be the other way around.
Fairies, you see, are nearly physically incapable of telling lies. Smartass, why are we in town?
We're running away from a rich dude you pissed off in Kalfath.
And?
And an Imperial forcer blackmailed you into hunting the kidnapper lurking in Salmnath.
And do we mean to harm any of Rufio's friends?
I know I don't,
she said, putting her hand on her candy wrapper-covered chest.
But I can't speak for you. You could secretly be plotting to annihilate all children in Salmnath, and I wouldn't know. Actually, didn't you say you hated teens the other day? You know, shortly after you bought a bunch of slaves to serve your purposes?
Smartass, is this sabotage payback for the soda incident? Jeb asked.
Yes,
Smartass deflated. You remember what I said about sabotage and what would happen?
I was hoping you didn't,
she said, wincing. Clean the room with a toothbrush.
No!
Smartass howled as her wings dragged her away to seek out a toothbrush.
You bought a bunch of slaves? Rufio asked, brows up. Cool.
"That's what you're impressed by?" Jeb asked, dragging a hand down his face. "Never mind. Of course that's what you're impressed by. Listen up, kid. You already saw everyone I bought. It wasn't a power trip or some misguided attempt at finding a waifu. I bought normal, everyday people with job experience handling brats like you."
"Even Mrs. Everett?"
"Even Mrs. Everett." Rufio bit his lip, studying Jeb for a moment.
"What's your plan to catch this guy?"
"Thank you, Mrs. Everett." "All right, take a seat," Jeb said, motioning to the bench. "But first, I never got your name."
"Colt,"
the kid said. "Jebediah Trapper. You can call me Sir or Mr. Trapper."
"Sounds fair, Jeb,"
Colt said, sitting at the table with his legs splayed in an obvious power move. "God, I hate teenagers," Jeb thought, his knuckles tightening around his cane. He couldn't allow these pubescent sharks to smell blood, though, so he shrugged it off and sat down. "Okay. My plan at first was to kidnap kids en masse and hide them away to attract the attention of the culprit and lure him out, but it's evolved to fit the circumstances a bit better. With your help, I could take a much easier route with less chance of horrible failure."
"What's that?"
"This place is going to become an orphanage," Jeb said, motioning to the building around them. "With you out in the wild convincing kids to come here at a much faster rate than I could ever manage alone, we won't have to kidnap any of them, and we can be out in the open. Word will spread faster if I don't have to be all secretive about it, and that means the kidnapper will hear about it that much sooner."
"What's in it for us? Being bait and all?"
Colt asked, arms crossed. "Oh, you mean besides food, safety, actual beds to sleep in, and classes from the best teachers I could buy?" Jeb asked. "Nothing. Learn to live with it." Colt growled a bit, but accepted the terms. Smartass zipped back in with Jeb's toothbrush and started cleaning the oiliest, gunkiest motor parts she could find, making hard eye contact with Jeb as she did. "Once you're done cleaning the room, get me a fancy new electric toothbrush," Jeb said. "Mint in box."
"Yeah. What's your plan for dealing with this guy when he comes here?"
Colt asked over the sound of fairy tears. "The way I see it, there are two major paths this guy can take in response to losing his prey." Jeb held up two fingers. "First, if he has no political backing and no assistance, he'll most likely come sniffing around the orphanage in person, looking to break in or lure a child away. In that situation, we simply catch him in the act, murder him, and bury him in the backyard. Problem solved." He could tell from Colt's expression that the teen approved. "The other way this could play out is if this guy has political clout. He might set out to delegitimize the orphanage and have the government act on his behalf to scatter the children to the wind so he can hunt them again."
"How do we deal with that one?"
Colt asked. "Substantially more complicated. We would have to follow the trail of paperwork and complaints back to whoever got the ball rolling, then find and murder them without getting caught. Much more tricky."
"How are you going to do that?"
"I'll figure something out. Probably bribe the right people."
"All right, let's do this,"
Colt said, smacking his fist into his palm.
"I can't wait to fuck this asshole up."
"You're mistaken. Your job is to bring in kids, and only bring in kids. I'm not interested in having a teen involved with the murdering part."
"Screw that,"
Colt said, beating his chest.
"I'm a level 24 slinger."
To demonstrate, he picked up a tiny metal rod off Eddie's desk and whipped it around, burying it several inches deep in the stone walls of the basement.
"I survived the hard tutorial. I can handle it."
"And to prove you can handle it, you damage my property, you little shit." "Whoop-de-doo," Jeb said, wiggling his finger. "My orphanage, my plan, my rules." Jeb raised an eyebrow. "Unless you were planning on starting your own orphanage with your own mansion, money, and servants." Colt glared at him for a good 15 seconds, and Jeb was wondering what teen angst would spill out of his mouth when the boy finally agreed to do what was asked of him.
"I'll go get the others,"
Colt said, standing and moving to brush by Jeb. "Remember," Jeb said, catching Colt as he walked past, "it's absolutely critical you don't tell the other children that they're bait. Word gets around fast, and one slip will spook the man we're hunting. If he spooks, we get nothing."
"Just a mansion to live in, plenty of food and servants,"
Colt asked. You never see Nancy again. Colt glared at him a moment.
I'll keep my mouth shut.
Thank you, Colt. Colt peeled Jeb's hand off his arm.
I'm gonna be keeping a list, Pops.
Oh?
I'm gonna keep track of everyone I send here, and if one kid from my list goes missing in your orphanage, it's your ass.
Fair enough. Colt left the cellar, the sun flooding the basement as he left the large doors open. I think that went about as well as can be expected, Jeb said. And he's totally going to ignore my instructions and try to kill the kidnapper himself, isn't he? Teens were predictably unpredictable.
I hate you,
Smartass sobbed as she scrubbed the filth off the floor in tight brushstrokes. You hate me right now. Once you're done with your punishment, we'll talk about resetting the sabotage truce. Ernok the Rabzi. Ernok the Rabzi was sleeping peacefully when an odd sound woke him up. Rrr, 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 rrr. Ernok's ears perked up, swiveling independently to orient the sound. A quiet rumbling, something like a soft earthquake or distant thunder, only it was constant, unchanging. Unnatural. Ernok leapt to his feet, snatching up his club with sharp rocks embedded in it. He let out a full-throated howl, his lips peeling back from his teeth to show off his natural weapons. Unnatural sounds meant something was causing it. Something made of meat and fear. Both tasted wonderful to a Rabzi. The other Rabzi in the den started awake, grabbing their precious pointy weapons and cocking their heads, ears swiveling to catch the same sound Ernok had. A moment of silence allowed Ernok's howl to echo. Then, in an unspoken agreement, the swarm of Rabzi leapt into action, pouring out of the cave entrance like a howling tide of lean rage. Ernok would have been swept away by the tide if he wasn't part of it, throwing every strand of muscle into being the first. So many benefits aligned with being the first. First to eat, first to breed, first to fight. Ernok's mouth hung open, his tongue lolling out in the wind, slobber dripping along behind him as he imagined the tangy taste of meat. There, down the side of the barren mountain, was the cause of the noise. A strange black bug thing that crawled close to the ground, ungangly and slow. It seemed to have a single arm that grew off of its back, a pathetic amount of defense. Ernok was disappointed there wasn't more food. The strange bug would barely feed 10 of them. That arm swung around and pointed at them, something spinning on the front of it. Ernok the Rabzi ceased to exist before he even knew what hit him. Jeb. A flash of light preceded the rolling thunder of the explosion coming down from the Rabzi-infested mountain. Boom! The sound washed over Jeb and Eddie, diluted by distance. Beer? Jeb asked, reaching into the cooler and retrieving an ice-cold bottle before throwing up his feet and reclining in the lawn chair, watching the side of the mountain with the peeping Tom wand and scouting potential monster nests.
Almost level 20,
Eddie said, waving off the drink and shaking his head. The old man had hacked the bomb disposal robot's controller to support VR, then installed it in a portable antenna that could beam the robot instructions from about a mile away. It even had its own generator that could keep the thing running a good 8 hours on a single tank. Plenty of time to hunt monsters. The old man himself was glancing around, the VR helmet stuck to his face, plastic controller held out like a pistol.
Take that, you son of a bitch!
Eddie muttered, pointing with the controller and clicking. Boom! The fireball wand triggered in the distance, claiming more lives. About 4 hours of industrial-strength monster slaughter later, the bony old man leapt to his feet, arms raised.
Woohoo! Level 20! This whole leveling thing isn't so bad. I could see how you kids could get into it. It's showing me a bunch of class options,
Eddie said, taking off the helmet and blinking, trying to make them go away.
Oh, sleepless sentinel! I no longer need to sleep!
The old man's eyes went watery as he seemed to picture a life without mandatory rest. Don't pick that one, Jeb interrupted. You'll go insane.
Don't treat me like one of your orphans,
Eddie scoffed.
I know what I'm doing.
Do you really?
Jeb asked, tilting his straw hat to ward off the sun.
Scholar, professor, alchemist, artisan, jack of all trades. Oh, here we go. Mystic roboteer. 5 to nerve and mist with a passive bonus for hybridizing technology and building robots, along with an active ability that lets me interact with computer programming without an interface. Holy shit!
A couple seconds later, the old man winced, clutching his head.
Gonna take a while to get used to that.
5 to both of the man's favorite attributes along with a class was more than enough profit for the day. The two of them packed up their stuff and threw it onto Buddy's storage rack, then drove the bot up into the back of the Jeep. The entire drive home, Eddie sported a vacant expression, likely interfacing with Buddy without a console. The Admiral Orphanage had gone from a small group of frightened children hiding in a corner of the mansion on day one to an absolute madhouse 3 weeks in. No less than 150 kids littered the grounds, running and screaming at the top of their lungs at the drop of a hat while exhausted adults tried to keep them contained, casting Jeb irate glances every now and then. Eddie broke off for the storm cellar, the last bastion of relative quiet in the entire mansion. Jeb was tempted to follow him, but Mrs. Lang had already seen him come in the front gate, and hiding would simply prolong the inevitable. Jeb stepped inside the mansion and took off his coat, nearly tripping over a toddler running past him and screaming mindlessly, "Sans pants." "How do we do today, Mrs. Lang?" Jeb asked.
"Harv and Rory went out again and spread the rumor that kids might be disappearing from the orphanage, that there might be some more sinister purpose at work, bringing all these children together."
"Excellent," Jeb said. She frowned.
"I don't feel like this is the best method to catch this man. But I'll do as I'm told, boss. What if the law comes, looking to catch a reaper?"
"Then they're probably the bad guys," Jeb said. "I have it on high authority that the Empire simply doesn't have the resources or give a shit to protect human non-citizens. It doesn't matter how bad our rep is, the good guys aren't going to come knocking." Knock, knock. Someone rapped on the other side of the mansion's front door before Jeb had even finished taking off all of his adventuring gear. Jeb frowned and turned to glance at the door. Mrs. Lang shrugged. Jeb clomped up to the door and opened it, revealing a pale Keegan looming high above him. The thin man was wearing finely crafted Keegan clothes, voluminous and flowing. And he was armed.
Chapter 16. Throttled.
"Hey, Zlesk!" Jeb exclaimed upon seeing the Keegan sheriff gracing his doorstep. "How's it going?"
"Sure is nice to see him again. He's a good guy. I wonder what he's doing here, though. Him taking a vacation that soon after me leaving doesn't sound right. He seemed to really like his job. Maybe..."
Jeb's eyes went wide as he put two and two together just as the massive Keegan lunged forward. Jeb wasn't small by any means, but he wasn't huge either. He was right in that comfortable range where no one had ever truly throttled him. Jeb had heard the term used before, but when the 7-foot Keegan clamped his vice-like hands around Jeb's neck and shoulders before shaking him like a disobedient toddler, he knew what it felt like.
"You ruined me! Shake, shake. You ruined my career! Shake, shake. You ruined my life!"
The ceiling wobbled, and Jeb's vision darkened a little as the blood to his brain was cut off. Jeb wanted to say something eloquent that would mollify the enraged giant bony man, but it came out as a garbled croak.
"3 generations! Shake, shake, shake. Scrimped and saved to buy our citizenship."
Jeb responded. "Shake, shake, shake.
And you ruined it overnight. Shake. I'm a citizen with no standing. How can I pass on that legacy to my heirs when I have no standing?"
Jeb held up a finger to launch a counterpoint, but couldn't force air through his neck beyond a rattle. Click. Both of them went still upon hearing the metallic sound of a gun cocking. Mrs. Everett, her flabby arms quivering with determination and no small amount of Parkinson's, aimed a .38 at Zlesk's temple.
"Let go of Mr. Trapper, Boney."
Mrs. Everett said. Jib glanced down to the old woman's apron, slightly less bulgy than before. Does she carry that weapon around in her apron? There's got to be some kind of a safety hazard in an orphanage. On the stairs above the foyer, the janitors and Mr. Everett were clomping down, while Mrs. Lang and the other lunch lady were cordoning off child looky-loos. Jeb sucked in a grateful gasp of air as Lesk released his neck, huge thin fingers unclasping from around him. In a blur of motions, Lesk knocked the gun aside faster than Jeb could see. Boom! The deafening sound of a .38 at point-blank range, amplified by the close quarters, tore through Jeb's ears. As his eardrums were ringing, Jeb did a quick self-eval, mentally scanning his body for pain or holes that weren't put there by God. Nothing. Zlesk winced and shook his palm, a squished piece of lead and a couple drops of blood falling off of it.
This is between me and Jebediah Trapper. I have no quarrel with any of you, he said, looking up at the four men on the staircase. But if you attack me, I may defend myself without repercussion.
Mr. Everett opened his mouth, glanced down at his wife rubbing her bruised, shaking hand, and paused for a moment.
Take it outside, away from the children.
Dude!
Jeb exclaimed before Zlesk hauled him back out the door. He'd been hoping for some kind of you attack him, you attack all of us, but Jeb had made the mistake of hiring sane, rational people. None of the teachers could compete with someone who could catch a bullet, and they knew it. Jeb got dragged out onto the mansion grounds, all the children gawking at the 7-foot-tall bone giant who hauled the owner of the orphanage through the courtyard, then over the hedge to the next property over. When Zlesk dropped him on the flagstone around the edge of the neighbor's swimming pool, he seemed to have calmed down in the interim. The former sheriff prodded his rapidly purpling hand, watching Jeb out of the corner of his eye.
I regret losing my temper. I was upset.
So Grenor got you fired, huh? Jeb asked, coming to his foot. It was the only reason he could see that the sheriff might have lost his job and would blame Jeb for it.
He wanted to discredit or eliminate any witness to his humiliation. I'm a citizen, and therefore he could not risk killing me. So instead, the tycoon launched an aggressive campaign to have me removed from office and stripped of my standing. Mere hours after you left his office, all your posters were down, replaced with ones that muddied the water and called for my resignation. Hundreds of bulbs changed hand, and in the end, Zlesk spread his hands. I received a dismissal from the head office for allowing Miss Grenor to be kidnapped. And here I am.
What about the enforcer?
Zlesk snorted. I wish he'd tried. Mr. Collis could have put the buffoon out of our misery before his campaign against me amounted to anything. Sadly, Garland isn't that stupid. Imperial enforcers have a license to kill and very little oversight. He let her be until she simply left on more important matters.
Well, how can you get your standing back? Jeb asked.
Oh, there are ways, but all of them amount to either greasing a staggering amount of palms or accomplishing some monumentally dangerous task. Climbing back up is harder than falling down.
Would working closely with an Imperial enforcer and killing a Reaper do it? Jeb asked. Zlesk's eyebrows skyrocketed for a moment.
Honestly? No. No, it wouldn't be enough. Zlesk cocked his head. But it would be an excellent start to regaining my status within the Empire.
I got the job offer right before I left Kalfath. Haven't earmarked the credit for the kill to anyone, Jeb said, shrugging.
Would you like to make a deal? Like your arrangement with Grenor? You might not remember, but I witnessed that farce firsthand. I'll pass.
Zlesk waved his hand dismissively. Most of the setup to lure the Reaper out has already been done, Jeb said. Help me for the last little bit, and all the positive credit for the operation will be owed to you. Someone who can catch a bullet would be appreciated when we finally confront the murderer.
Jeb, you can't lie about who did all the work,
Smartass whispered into his ear.
No, but I can assign credit. What do you think?
I'll even let you dictate the terms.
I think it could be a colossal waste of time.
Zlesk thumbed his chin, cocking his head in thought.
But if I get to dictate the terms... Give me 100 bulbs as collateral, the price of my heir's citizenship, and I'll do what it takes to help you catch your reaper. If we succeed in a spectacular fashion, then I will exchange your money for public crediting of my involvement. If you muck it up and incite public outrage or political blowback again, I will walk away with your money and deny all involvement with you. Jeb felt a smile blooming. Do you take gold bullion?
Acceptable.
Deal. Jeb felt the somewhat more complicated bargain click into place inside him, urging him to fork over a little over 6 pounds of gold. And now we've got someone who can actually fight, Jeb thought. While the two were shaking hands, Colt leapt over the hedge, a sling whirling over his head.
Get down, Pops! I got this!
Teenagers, Jeb thought, rolling his eyes. The teen unleashed a lead pellet with the distinctive crack of an object breaking the sound barrier, straight for Jeb's new hire.
Stop!
Jeb shouted as Zlesk flickered out of the way, the bullet puncturing the ground behind him.
Shing!
Zlesk drew his blade, and Jeb thought he was about to see a diced Colt. The Kikan charged forward, using the hilt of the blade to deflect a second bullet before punching for Colt's head. Colt responded with a spray of mystic slime, covering the sheriff and just about everything else in zero-friction goop. Zlesk's eyes went wide as his feet slipped, throwing his punch wide before he tumbled to the ground, sliding into the hedge in a lanky heap.
Take my friends? I'll fucking kill you, Boney!
Colt pulled out a knife and went for the coup de grace, and Jeb used a ball of hardened air to jab him in the nose. The boy staggered, clutching his face, giving Zlesk time to get his bearings. Zlesk's palm found purchase in the slime somehow, and he flipped, reaching up to catch Colt's wrist. There was a hum that was more felt than heard, and Colt's wrist was dragged down to the ground. Zlesk touched the boy's forehead and shoulder, and soon he was stapled to the ground by invisible force.
Let go of me! I'll kill you!
Colt shouted into the dirt, followed by some more wordless screaming and spraying of zero-friction goop.
What did I do to offend this one?
Zlesk asked, coming to his feet. From the way he moved, Jeb could tell he was using his class ability to secure his own body to the ground. The sheriff's belt was slipping off because of the slime, and his sword had long since flown away into the hedges.
He thinks you're the bad guy. Give me a minute to sort this out.
Jeb carefully stabilized himself with his own mist as he walked through Colt's slime zone and crouched in front of the kid.
Calm down, Jeb said.
He's right there,
Colt shouted.
And you helped him!
That ain't the guy we're looking for, and there's no reasonable way it could be, since he was the sheriff of a town nearly a month north of us until a few weeks ago.
Colt peered at him with a single angry eye from where his face was planted in the ground.
That's a pretty good lesson on why I don't want you fighting the kidnapper yourself, though. Zlesk beat you easily.
Jeb poked the teen's shoulder.
You helped him!
Who knows? There might be more than one.
Jeb said with a shrug. Kibos Osset. Kibos Osset, or Lennis Serpy to the children, watched from the balcony as his newest acquisition slaughtered Rabsy by the dozen alongside her peers. The feral creature snarled at the children before they died, but the little girl no longer flinched and mewled, instead having grown numb to the fuzzy creature's threat displays. She simply speared the restrained animals in the neck and moved on to the next cage. About time, Kivas thought, ire simmering under his expressionless surface.
How is your product coming, Mr. Osset?
Judge Elcor asked, joining him on the balcony overlooking the courtyard. The Giga Man was wearing his work attire, a black and blue checkered affair. Even at a party, the judge wanted everyone to know who he was and what his station was. The man was a raging narcissist. Kibos swallowed his personal distaste and motioned to the 8 children killing Cage Robsy.
Those three have shown complete regeneration on the scar test. We will get them ready to ship by the end of the week. The other five are newly acquired. It will be some time before they are ready.
If they showed complete regeneration, why not kill them now? They are immortal now, are they not?
Here, hold this, the judge said, shoving his drink into Kibos's hand before rolling up his sleeves, crackling energy dancing along his fingers.
Which one is mine?
Elcor asked, his eyes dancing with mirth as he scanned the unaware children.
Judge, I do not mean to be a wet blanket, but the scar test is not 100% accurate. Our standard practice is a 5-point buffer of body to be absolutely sure they have achieved immortality. You wouldn't want to pay for a dud, would you?
I'm sure it'll be fine. I trust your skill.
If you trust my skill, then let me perform my business my way,
Kibos shouted in his head.
You think I could hit that one in the head from here?
Elcor said, closing a single eye and lining up a finger covered in brilliant sea-green energy.
I bet I could.
The child he was pointing at wasn't even one of the three he'd pointed out. The judge was doing it specifically to get under Kibos's skin.
Your Honor,
Kibos said, choosing his words carefully and treading the fine line between obsequious and forceful.
If a child is killed in front of the rest of them, it will spoil the entire batch. Are you willing to pay for all 8 of them when only 3 are possibly worth the money? I can't imagine the other investors would be pleased.
The judge's eyes opened and he glanced at Kibos before lowering his finger, mist fading.
I suppose not. You shouldn't put them on display like that if you don't want people taking potshots at them. It's lazy and a safety hazard, Kibos.
I'll take care of it right away, Judge,
Kibos said, bowing as the man left.
What an ass,
the Lady Nevere said, idly stirring her drink as she approached, cloaked in her lovely gown. The Kegan woman's cheekbones were high and stood out to a tremendous degree that always made Kibos wonder if she'd had work done. Kibos chose not to respond to her comment. He was merely the supplier, a low class of citizen compared to the movers and shakers of Solmnath. He couldn't afford to choose sides, even though the woman was absolutely correct.
Just 8?
The lady asked as she leaned over the balcony, brow raised.
I don't mean to criticize your math, but there are more than 8 of us.
Apologies, my lady, but the current supply of Rabzi can only support 8 at a time. If we were to stretch the impact too thin, it simply wouldn't work. Your immortal will be shipped in the order they were acquired. I apologize for the inconvenience.
You do not have to take that tone with me,
Nevere said, waving him off.
I understand limitations, and you are the expert, are you not?
Her eye scanned the 8 distant figures hungrily.
Tell me, is mine in here?
As you requested, a young female with pale skin,
Kibos said, pointing out Nancy.
The specificity of your request made finding one a little more difficult, but not impossible. She still has a few weeks to bake, for lack of a better word.
Why keep the Rabzi in a cage? Why not just restrain them entirely? Or better yet, put them on an assembly line and have the children press a button?
She asked, taking a drink.
Because it wouldn't work. Impact transmission is dulled the more degrees of separation there are between the act and the result. It would be possible to arrange a system like you described, but the children would receive next to nothing in return. The 2 most important features of impact transmission are awareness of purpose and directness of causation. If the child doesn't know their actions are killing a living creature, the system places the responsibility for its death on another. And if the Rabzi are completely restrained and murdered by proxy,
This system likewise assigns the majority of its impact elsewhere. Of course, by this logic, we're taking a hit from keeping the Rabzi in cages, but allowing them freedom to act would result in all the children dying.
I said you were the expert. I didn't mean that I wanted to be one, too,
Nevers said, her tone sharp. Kibos bowed low. My apologies, my lady.
Apology accepted, she said with faint amusement. I know how you scholarly types tend to get carried away. Your grandfather was much the same.
Kibos clenched his jaw and bit his tongue.
Your knowledge and enthusiasm instills me with confidence in you, Osut. Keep up the good work.
Lady Nevers eyed Nancy one more time before sauntering away.
Thank you, my lady,
Kibos said, heart pounding in his temples as he continued to bow until he mastered control over his expression. He would never let these people see that they'd gotten to him. Once he was calm, Kibos cast one look at the practicing children before turning back to the golden light spilling from his party, which hosted a swath of the wealthiest citizens in the city. Something unheard of for a man with a background as humble as Kibos.
They wouldn't breathe the same air as me, Kibos thought as he greeted, flirted, and laughed at their awful jokes. Were it not for their need of me.
The stitching of humanity represented an opportunity, and Kibos intended to rise beyond the grandson of a disgraced scholar. The humans called impact experience, and foolishly believed it was a simple measure of an opponent's strength. It seemed they already had some kind of rudimentary myths pertaining to it, but the savages didn't understand how it worked the way the Kigan did. And the Kigan didn't understand impact the way Kibos did. If a child has a large amount of time value in their impact due to the amount of time and potential they have to choose their fate, then how much time value would an immortal child have? Many thousands of times more than the Rabzi that they spent to create them. Many thousands. Kibos was chatting with the mayor and his wife when one of his underlings tugged on his sleeve. It was a young hornless Milas with lighter skin, more pleasing to the pale Kigan nobility.
Apologies, but the work never stops,
Kibos said, excusing himself and stepping away. He dragged the underling off to the side where the two of them wouldn't be overheard.
What?
The Rabzi in the mountains have dried up, the Mila said with a wince. The collectors are charging us full price for a quarter of the Rabzi.
Define dried up.
The Mila shrugged, glancing around evasively.
The hunting isn't so good anymore. There have been reports of explosions echoing across the mountains for weeks now, and the hunters tell me they've come across hundreds of charred corpses.
Probably a young aristocrat flexing a new fire core,
Kibos said, waving it off.
Their numbers will recover, as always. In the meantime, hire fishermen to catch Perua.
That'll be expensive,
the Milas wheedled.
Focus on keeping the flow of impact steady first,
Kibos said, poking his underling in the chest.
Expense second. These aren't the kind of people you shortchange. Now, is there anything else?
We're having trouble finding children to match the specifications of 16 of your investors.
16?
Kibos hissed.
There are thousands of human children in the city alone, hundreds of whom have no guardian at all. You are telling me that among all that choice, we are having a hard time finding them?
Well, since you took Nevers' order in, there's been a bit of a shift on the streets.
Go on,
Kibos said, motioning for the Milas to continue.
A human orphanage has opened out of the old Lenon manor, run by a human with one leg. It's managed to take most children of the appropriate age off the streets.
One headache after another,
Kibos said, rubbing his temples. You see a problem? I see an opportunity. With the children all in one place, it'll be as simple as going to the Great Bazaar with a shopping list. I'll handle this myself. Deal with the fishermen.
One more thing.
The underling caught Kibos' sleeve again, earning a baleful glare.
There's a rumor going around that some of the children are disappearing from the orphanage.